Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Good to have you with us today. This hour, we're going to be visiting a part of Michigan State's campus that's kind of a slice of Willy Wonka's factory. It's the MSU Dairy, which churns out thousands of gallons of ice cream every year.
All right, so this is the freezing center. This is where we make the ice cream. That's where the flavoring would be added. In this case, we're making espresso, electric espresso, we call it here at MSU.
Bring your spoon. We're headed there in just a bit. But first, as our local newspapers continue to struggle, some regions of Michigan are lucky to have online news services stepping in to fill the information gap. Or are they? One that got up and running last year called Prism News recently disappeared into thin air. Prism emerged promising to cover Grand Traverse County, but there were a lot of things about it that seemed a little off. Max Howard of Interlochen Public Radio has been looking into Prism's life and seeming demise, and he joins us now. Hey, Max.
Hey, April. Good to be here.
You know, I think we've all seen websites popping up promising local stories that'll make an impact. And some of these come from actual newsrooms with reporters and editors. And then there are some that just set up using AI to scrape content off of other news websites. When did you first become aware of Prism?
Yeah, well, I came across it in the process of my reporting. You know, I mean, I look online to see what other people are reporting, what's being talked about online. You know, and in Grand Traverse County, there's a Facebook group. I started noticing these Prism stories, you know, these links being put in that group first. And, you know, it's a small community up here. I think I know all the news rooms around here, and I'd never heard of Prism.
Yeah. When you started looking at their work, what were their stories like?
They were, I mean, a lot of it, you know, was things that were already being reported. And a lot of these stories, I'm like, oh yeah, I saw that at 9 and 10, or I saw that in Up North Live or The Ticker. So none of them really got my attention that much, except that I had seen them somewhere else and I had never heard of this place before.
Yeah. Were there certain clues or tells that maybe had you questioning whether this was a for real newsroom?
Definitely. The first thing is, so some of their stories, they would convert to short form, like reels and stuff like that. And when they do that, they get an AI like narrator. So you'll notice instead of saying Traverse City, they say Traverse City. But besides that, they also have these, I mean, just really crazy AI illustrations is what they call them. And, you know, the story will be about something that happened at the courthouse downtown. And then they will accompany that with an AI illustration, a photo of that courthouse. And all of a sudden it looks like we're in the Vatican or something, you know? And I'm like, hey, I was just there a couple days ago reporting on a story. I don't remember the terrace. So it's kind of this uncanny valley vibe, but not every story has that. A lot of them, you know, you can scroll right past and they'll pass for real stories.
How did you find out who was staffing Prism once you started looking into them in a little more formal way?
I mean, a lot of that was, you know, reading the fine print. So, and looking at their socials. So their LinkedIn page, if you type in Prism Media instead of Prism News, it's the parent company. You'll see they had three people listed, and then there was like one unknown person, or they'd had their profile blocked on LinkedIn. But all of them were from Tel Aviv, Israel. I mean, they all seemed to go to the same university together. They had some venture capitalist background already. Some of them had, you know, worked in New York before starting this new venture. So that's really how I found them.
Yeah. I think I get the sense of the quality of the work from some of the things you told us. And it sounds like once you started reporting on them, there were others asking questions about Prism and its operations. Can you explain who Emily Horn is and how you came to know her work?
Yeah, Emily Horn, she's someone who has ties to Northern Michigan, but she's this comms professional who's worked in several high-ranking federal government positions, the State Department, National Security Council. She's now writing a Substack called Spin Class. It's about the news. And that's where she wrote about, you know, following up on my reporting.
And let's listen to a little bit of what Emily Horn told you about what she found.
I was surprised at how forthcoming they were about what their business model was. And I actually ran it by an IP and media attorney who confirmed that this is actually in maybe a little bit more damning than just saying we just take other people's news and try to pass it off as our own. Mm-hmm. Their business model, and I'm paraphrasing here, but only slightly, is that they have proprietary AI tools that scrape the web, including original journalism, that they kind of Frankenstein together what they find with a new framing and republish it under the quote unquote byline of an AI journalist. And then they push it back out to those same local audiences or niche hobbyist audiences that the original content was created for in the first place.
Wow. They just told her that.
Yeah. And that's how they position themselves. And, you know, they had one press release. But the way they describe themselves there as, you know, we are coming in, we're going to be the service that provides news in news deserts, which is really ironic because the only way it can function is by scraping from a place that has news outlets. So that promise was never going to be fulfilled.
Did you notice something happening at Prism's website after folks like you and Emily started asking questions?
After my first piece came out, I did, you know, I was in contact with them, sending emails. I never got, you know, one of the co-founders on the record, but they just weren't saying where they were getting these stories from. I did notice that in a few stories, they would say, you know, as reported by, you know, local newsroom 9 and 10 or something. But still, that attribution was really far and few between in some of the photos that they would directly lift from other newsrooms. They would say courtesy of, you know, Up North Live, which, you know, it's not really courtesy of it if you're taking it directly without asking.
Right.
But that was the previous attribution that they were giving.
Just to be clear, Max, you said after you'd asked for some corrections, like had they attributed your stories or used them without attribution?
Yeah, there were a few that they had used of mine. And I did ask for corrections, really kind of as a test, because, you know, they said on their website that they were, you know, you could write in with corrections on anything. And to their credit, they did fix it, I mean, within hours. But, you know, I can only imagine how many little mistakes that go unnoticed because, you know, they had around 200 of these sites running at the same time. It's just thousands of stories that they're doing. There's no way that four people could fact check or even just have the, you know, the context for all of these stories. So I imagine the error rate was pretty high. But again, that's me speculating.
So you reported last week that Prism appears to have just folded up its shutters and pulled down the shingle and pretty much disappeared the website. What gives? I mean, do you have any reason for knowing why the creators of Prism might have taken it down?
I really don't know. I mean, what they said on their website, and I just brought it up since you mentioned it. If you go to prismnews.com, there's three lines, and the first one says, "We've currently completed our experiment," which I did not know this was an experiment. It seemed like a kind of business that they were trying to run. And then they say all activity is suspended for the foreseeable future. I reached out to one of the co-founders and they did not explain why or reach back out to me as to why it shut down. I will say, you know, in my reporting and then through Emily's, we were able to talk about some of the liabilities that this could cause Prism. One of them was a story that I worked on where, you know, it was a sensitive topic. I was talking about a minor who had committed a crime and, you know, was seeing the consequences of that crime. During that story, we decided not to name the minor because A, they're under 18. B, we don't need this following this kid around who's starting a new life and is doing well. So that was an editorial decision we made. When Prism reprinted that story, you know, whatever AI algorithm they had crawled the internet, found that kid's name and put it in the story.
Oh, wow.
I think there are just unknown liabilities like that that can rear their ugly heads. And I'd like to think that when they read Emily's piece where we talked about that specific example, maybe that turned some heads and, you know, made them think there's more to this and there's more liability than we realized.
Yeah. I guess there's no way for sure, knowing for sure if the financial piece of it was really working out for them either. Do you have any sense of whether the company was indeed making money either on its Prism site for Northern Michigan or any of its enterprises?
Well, there was an attempt to make money for sure because, you know, going back to that original press release, they're talking about how there's not money in local media because it's not scalable, right? So their idea was to aggregate all the news, aggregate in quotes, steal news from local outlets, put it all on one site, and then they can get a lot of ad traffic and advertise on it. So when I was doing my first report, there were no ads. After that, lots of ads started coming in. I'd have to say they're pretty low quality. They look like the thing, the kind of ad that you can't make a lot of money off of unless there's a lot of volume. So there was an attempt. I don't know how much traffic they actually had to these sites, but that was how they were trying to make money eventually.
For sure. Maxwell Howard works in the Interlochen Public Radio newsroom. You can find his stories about Prism at interlochenpublicradio.org, a site that I might add is entirely created and populated by real human beings. Max, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back, a Michigan scholar's take on Dolly Parton's gifts to the world.
She didn't label people and she didn't want to label herself.
More in a minute. You're with Stateside. Singer, songwriter, businesswoman, philanthropist, humanitarian, and legend, Dolly Parton left us yesterday. She was 80 years old.
Oh, sometimes I go walking through fields where we walked long ago in the sweet used to be. And the flowers still grow, but they don't smell as sweet as they did when you picked them for me. And when I think of you and the love we once knew, how I wish we could go back in time.
Back in time.
Do you ever think back on like that? Or do I ever cross your mind?
It's crazy to think we'll only hear that voice in recordings going forward, but such recordings and such a legacy to all kinds of Americans who were touched by Parton's creative spark, her humor, and her generous, loving nature. Nadine Hubbs is a professor of women and gender studies at the University of Michigan and author of the forthcoming book, Border Sounds and Buckaroos, The Mexican History of Country Music. She's also authored several scholarly works about Dolly Parton. Dean, welcome back to Stateside. It's so good to talk to you.
Thank you so much, April. It's great to be back with you.
You have spent so much time thinking and writing about Dolly. I just wondered how you're feeling today.
I'm really sorry this is happening now.
Yeah.
But, and so many of us are really gutted, sort of beyond what we could have expected. I'm not someone who has parasocial relationships with celebrities, and many others who are not. This is really gutting. And it's because she was. The language eludes us. There are just not other people in our lifetime who compare with Dolly Parton. And she, in so many ways, she was the best of us. And there will never be another. The consolation, if there is any, is that, of course, she prepared from earliest childhood to meet her maker and go to her glory. And after all that she gave us, that we have years to go over all that she gave us. It's going to take that long. Dolly didn't owe us a thing.
Yeah. Dean, a lot of people know your scholarship for Dolly's song, Jolene. But Dolly enthusiasts know that Jolene or any one single song is really just the tip of the iceberg for her catalog. And I wonder if there are other songs of hers that have been coming up for you that speak to her power as a songwriter.
Well, April, the song that... There are so many songs. She has over 3,000 songs. She's been in the American Songwriters Hall of Fame for years, I think over 25 years. She came in the early 2000s, and that's a huge accomplishment for any songwriter. She achieved it fairly early. She is one of this country's most distinguished songwriters.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. And so we could talk about 3,000 songs. Apparently her favorite song of her own catalog was Coat of Many Colors. And that is my favorite song in her catalog as well.
You wrote an essay for this song when it was added to the National Registry back in 2011. And I was astonished to read that Dolly was like 24 or 25 when she wrote this incredibly moving, evocative song about her childhood and the coat that her mother sewed for her.
Yeah, she was 25 when she recorded Coat of Many Colors. She wrote Jolene and I Will Always Love You on the same day in 1972. And when asked about that amazing feat, she said, it was a good writing day. 1971, the year before, she wrote Coat of Many Colors, which, as you say, is a really profound statement. It is, I would say, her most autobiographical song. And by that time, she's 25, and she had had about 12, 13 years to process what she, the trauma that she experienced that day when she was about, I think 11 or 12 years old, and she went to school on a day when, as she put it, she was going to have her picture made. And so she was very excited. And the night before, her mother had sewn a new coat for her because, as the lyrics had it, she didn't have a coat, and it was way down in the fall. And it was getting cold, and so the only material they had was a box of rags that they had been given by charity. And she sat with her mom as her mom sewed those rags together on the sewing machine. And in the song, she talks about the biblical story that her mom linked up to this coat that she was sewing. And by the end of it, and her mom finished the coat, it was this object bathed in glory. And then, of course, anyone who listens to the song, and everyone should, knows that after anticipating so highly, showing off this beautiful coat that her mama had sewn with love in every stitch, the other kids at school laughed at her. And they laughed at her out of mocking her poverty, her family's poverty.
Perhaps this coat will bring you good luck and happiness, and I couldn't wait to wear it, and Mama blessed it with a kiss. My coat of many colors that my mama made for me, made only from rags, but I wore it so proudly. I know we had no money, but I was rich as I could be in my coat of many colors my mama made for me.
I mean, it's a devastating moment for any kid.
Absolutely devastating moment of social humiliation and rejection. And reading beyond this, she had discussed it in later years. Apparently, she was abused. Too, that the kids got her, the boys got her in the coat closet and molested her.
Yeah.
On top of everything else. So the photo on the back cover of the album, which I have at the end of my essay, at the Library of Congress website for the National Recording Registry. She wrote a handwritten letter to her listeners who bought the album. And as she pointed out, here's my school picture from that day. And you can see my smile for Mama, because she was so excited about me having my picture made. Even after she had gone through that, she wanted to make sure she smiled. But you can also see a teardrop on her cheek.
Oh, my gosh.
She says, and the tears are playing in the picture, and so is the smile. So the song is powerful. It's like a little 3-minute song, and it just contains, you know, multitudes. But the power of an artist and a human heart that are capable of turning that kind of experience into this incredibly meaningful cultural landmark that has had an impact on so many millions of lives, that is stunning.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life.
And she wrote many powerful songs. A lot of people find 9 to 5 a really powerful statement about women in the workplace. And it is at the same time so witty and clever and danceable. And it is a powerful statement.
It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit.
A powerful feminist statement, whether or not Dolly claimed that term. Dolly was very resistant to partisan labels. And I imagine we might talk about that later, but she didn't label people, and she didn't want to label herself. And she had the courage to just meet each person outside categories.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dean Hubbs, country music scholar at the University of Michigan. And of course, we're talking about the late, the great Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton, in this way and many others, is close to the center of a lot of American stories, American narratives, our stories about women, our stories about women's work. And one of them really that keeps coming up for me thinking about her is what Dolly Parton says to us about class. One of 12 kids, you know, growing up with next to nothing. And she becomes this woman who is not only a success in her field, but she's an international celebrity. And she ended up making a brand out of her traditional roots, the fact that she did not have much. I opened my cupboard to make dinner last night and realized I had a box of her banana cake waiting for me. So I'll be baking that later this week as I remember her. How do you interpret the appeal that she wove out of this story about a girl who came from nothing and what America says to itself about girls who grow up that way?
What America usually says to itself about girls who grew up that way is not pretty. And Dolly, I mean, first of all, let's just say the obvious. Dolly Parton was a genius. And her genius operated on multiple levels. She was an absolute genius musician. If you think about over 60 years catalog, videos, live performances, you cannot find a clanker in, and I'm a musicologist, so I'm astonished that any musician could perform so incredibly consistently and impeccably for so many years. You can't find a clanker anywhere. You cannot hear her getting pitchy at any point ever in over 60 years. So musically, she was a genius. She was a child prodigy. She was already performing on the radio at age 5. She was performing in her grandfather's Pentecostal church in Tennessee. She's a genius of a songwriter. She wrote beautiful prose as well. She was an incredibly smart businesswoman. And that had to do with her starting so many businesses and branching out and spinning off and creating her brand. And also representing her brand, her persona, and her businesses. Incredible genius in that regard. So you can imagine by the time a celebrity gets to, say, marketing banana cake, that it could get old. But that didn't happen with Dolly. And I think for me, part of the reason that we never said, oh, you're just trying to make money off us, is that we also knew about her imagination library, about the way she had started Dollywood. Yeah, sure, as an amusement park, but she was employing the majority of Sevier County, Tennessee, her home county. And, you know, employing them in ways that they were really proud of, doing jobs that were meaningful to them.
It seems like she confounded a lot of traditional narratives about what happens, you know, what it means to make good in this world and what it means to do so while still being yourself.
Yeah. And you mentioned poor women and women who come from her background. She had the jokes and she would crack the jokes before you could. You know, one of her favorite lines was, takes a lot of money to look this cheap. Well, that's funnier than anything some smart aleck could have said to insult her in that way. And, you know, the other thing that comes to mind is the story she told about being a little girl in the mountains of Tennessee. And there was one woman in town who was disreputable, and everyone looked down on her. They were all Christians. And her name, well, she was Ruby the Town Tramp. And Dolly, as a little girl, looked at her with stars in her eyes and said, oh my goodness, I want to be just like you. And that she modeled herself on Ruby the Town Tramp. And it's really funny. It's very unexpected. And there's such a power of humanizing in these stories and wisecracks and jokes that she shared so often. Humanizing Ruby, explaining Dolly's choices, which some people would have criticized as being in poor taste, but she showed that she was already aware of how certain people were looking at her, and she still loved the glitter and the spangles, and chose it sincerely, truly loved.
Yeah,
how she looks.
Each step of the way, and I will always love you. I will always love you.
Among the many amazing songs in Dolly Parton's catalog is I Will Always Love You, which she wrote in 1973 in tribute to Porter Wagoner. It became a big hit on its own, but an even bigger smash and an instant karaoke classic when Whitney Houston recorded and released an unforgettable version in 1992. Let's take a listen.
Yeah!
When we come back, we'll have a little bit more with Professor Nadine Hubbs. We'll talk about how public radio connected her with Dolly. It's a really great story. Stay with us. This is Stateside. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking today with Professor Nadine Hubbs of the University of Michigan, whose scholarship covers country music and feminism. She's written about Dolly Parton and also appeared in the Radiolab miniseries Dolly Parton's America. If you listen to that podcast, you'll remember that Nadine composed and sang a fourth verse to Dolly Parton's famous song Jolene, in which Jolene and the narrator ditch the man at the center of the story and run off together instead. I forget if you ever met Dolly Parton.
I did not meet Dolly, and I didn't know when I added that queer fourth verse to Jolene on the Dolly Parton's America podcast in the Jolene episode. Because the producer egged me on. I had written, mused in an article. You know, there's so much homoerotics between the narrator and Jolene. I'm surely not the only person who has imagined that in a fourth verse, maybe the two women would get together and ditch that guy. And so then Shima Oliai, the producer of that Peabody award-winning podcast, hit me up. And just before I went down into the studios of Michigan Radio, I hadn't even showered yet. Shima texts me and says, "Hey, have you written that verse?" I said, "No." She's silent. I said, "Why? Do you want me to?" She's like, "Yeah." So I threw it together, figured out the chords, sang it in Dolly's key, which I can, barely croak out. When I got to the studio, and I told them, "Look, if you really want to use this, let's re-record it." I never heard from them about it again until the night before it was going to air, and Shima said it's going to air tomorrow. And I said, "I guess you cut that out in the edit." And she said, "Oh, no, Dolly's already heard it." So I didn't sleep that night. So I didn't meet Dolly, but Dolly heard me croaking out this fourth verse where the two women get together and ditch the guy. And finally, then the next day when I did hear the episode, I heard that Dolly was just incredibly good-natured about it. And she said, "Well, I never thought about it that way." But, she laughed. And I was saved because I thought, "Oh, well, here goes my career as a country music scholar." I've offended Dolly Parton. I've pissed off Dolly Parton because she had every right to be, I'm sure I violated copyright or something.
But she wasn't, because Dolly, right? Yeah, that's just,
no,
she accepted everything and everyone she met.
That's right. She did not accept evil. She didn't accept meanness. But she had accepted LGBTQ people for a long time and was an ally for decades. And she saw the humanity in everyone, and she loved people. And the way she put it, it was based in her faith. And the way that she put it was that I can't judge. Only God can judge. And there's a God light. God's light is in each one of us. And I want to see it. My job is to see it in each of us. And so I think that that's why some people would say that maybe she didn't want to lose sales, so she didn't declare one political position or another. But I really think it would have clashed with her whole perspective on her purpose in life, which is to see God's light in each person. If you put too many categories and labels on a person in advance, that will blind you to seeing God's light in them.
We are still receiving stories that are spreading about her generosity. A lot of people know about the Imagination Library and what she made possible in terms of literacy for America's kids. But there are stories about disaster relief, you know, different initiatives that she funded that, you know, a lot of us didn't even know about the generosity
Catholic
of her
charities.
Heart. Yeah.
Yeah. Catholic charities in the southern U.S. Who knew?
Yeah.
Dolly, of course, came up Pentecostal, was very much a Protestant, but she was a major donor to Catholic charities because they were doing good work and she kept track of who was doing good work.
Yeah. Forbes estimated Dolly's net worth at $450 million. And that catalog, those 3,000 songs, you know, that were her ultimate gift to us, I still hear them popping up all over the place. How do you see her music and her story enduring?
We are in a very unstable time right now and on the brink of possibly unimaginable changes in terms of media, circulation of information, and geopolitical changes that we cannot predict. So it's hard to predict that, but I would first of all say that if Dolly's net worth is $450 million, it's because she gave so much of it away. She would have easily been a billionaire. And I think that she felt that $450 million was quite enough, thank you. She chose and had been for decades figuring out how best to direct her wealth to help other people. And as you say, was incredibly effective with it. And by the way, just 2 years ago in my country music class at University of Michigan, I had a student who had received free books in the mail from Dolly's Imagination Library as a kid. He was a freshman from Detroit, had grown up low income, and was a fantastic student, incredibly well prepared, a country music fan, huge Dolly fan. And for his final presentation, it was so moving. His classmates were in tears. He had this really well put together thoughtful presentation about the Imagination Library, how these books came to him and his little brother, what they meant to them, and how they helped him to realize his own dreams up to this point in his life, because there he was in his freshman year at University of Michigan after coming up as a poor child in Detroit. You know, if we, as you say, more and more stories are pouring in about all the different places she shared her wealth. And she studied all those things. Of course, she wasn't just haphazardly. And that was the thing about Dolly. She focused her attention on others. And she did that at the level of groups, and she directed her generosity to places that needed it, and she did it on the level of individuals. And that's why we're also hearing stories from people who are talking about how magical it was to be in her presence. Siskel and Ebert, the Chicago Sun-Times, posted something yesterday that first Gene Siskel had met Dolly and interviewed her, and then a couple of years later for one of her other movies, Roger Ebert met her, and he talked to his colleague Gene Siskel and said, you know, this isn't sexual or weird or anything, but her presence was like it's something I'd never experienced before, and I just felt sort of healed by it. And Siskel said to him, yeah, I never told you I felt the same way.
Oh, wow. Gosh. Dean, thank you so much for all of your writing and all of your scholarship, but especially your writing about Dolly over the years. We just really, really appreciate it and your time today.
Thank you, April. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you.
Nadine Hubbs is professor of women and gender studies at the University of Michigan and author of the forthcoming book, Border Sounds and Buckaroos, The Mexican History of Country Music.
Your beauty is beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene. He talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene.
We've declared a new holiday on Stateside, more like a week-long festival. It's Ice Cream Week. You may have already heard our episode of On Hand answering a listener's question about whether Superman ice cream really is from Michigan. If you haven't already, go download it. Today, we're headed back to campus with the student body. Michigan State University's dairy operation has been producing fresh ice cream as part of its food science program for generations of Spartans. It's a tradition not only for students seeking a sweet treat, but also for residents of East Lansing and their surrounding communities. We met up with Matt Wilcox, who's the production and operations manager at the MSU dairy plant. He gave us a tour of the facility on a day when they were in ice cream production.
It does smell good in here. What am I smelling?
Probably smell the espresso ice cream.
All the floors in this place are slanted toward drains. This can be a slippery business after all. There's a large green S on the wall above the plant floor, and the room is filled with all the gleaming metal tanks and tubes you could hope for, processing milk into ice cream and cheese.
The production floor is kind of divided in half, sort of. This half is the cheese production side. So these vats behind me are cheese vats. We have a cheese press. After we hoop the cheese, we put it in the press, we package it, and then we have, if we were to make cheddar right now, we're looking at 6 months before we'd actually cut it and sell it.
So. You're telling me the cheddar cheese has to sit around for 6 months before it goes to the store?
Yes.
That's wild.
Yes, it is.
Okay, and the other half of the room is the ice cream operation?
You guys want to go see that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so this is the freezing center. This is where we make the ice cream. We talked about making the mix in the tanks in the other room, but we would pump the mix into the pasteurized tank. From the pasteurized tank, we would move that mix into the vats where Frida's looking right now. That's where the flavoring would be added. In this case, we're making espresso, electric espresso, we call it here at MSU. So it has an espresso base to flavor the mix. When we would send that into the ice cream freezer, the continuous ice cream freezer, where it would come off almost like soft serve. It would pass underneath the ingredient feeder that is dropping in espresso flakes. And above, right before it fills the tub, we incorporate a swirl. In this case, it's a salted caramel swirl into the ice cream. Jackson's filling the tubs right now. And then we have other students, they're putting lids on them. We put them in the chute door to be frozen. And then they stay in there overnight. And then we either leave them in that freezer upstairs or we have a freezer downstairs that we store them.
Are you telling me that there are MSU students who get to do their work study making ice cream?
Yes. Morey, she's an intern. She's a food science intern. She's worked in the plant for this summer. We have James and Connor. They're both students here at MSU, here for the experience. You know, one of the perks is they get to eat ice cream while they're here, so you can't really beat that. You guys can try it. I'll get you a taste of it.
You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding.
Oh, no way. That is right out of the machine. Mmm. Matt, it's so creamy. Wait a minute. How?
It's basically like soft serve. It's coming off at like 22 degrees. So this is like the hand-dipped ice cream before it's fully frozen. Having it this way is better than having it like fully frozen, in my opinion. But not a lot of people have the ability to try it like this.
That's incredible.
After getting our taste of electric espresso, executive producer Laura Weber-Davis and I sat down with Matt in his office, just off the dairy plant floor.
Hi, Matt.
Hi. How are you?
I'm so great. I just tasted one of the best ice creams I have ever had in my entire life.
Yeah, that's the best when it comes out, right out of the chute.
Can you tell us a little bit about the purpose of this production facility and why it's even here at MSU?
Yeah, so it's kind of unique. Michigan State offers the opportunity for students to get like hands-on experience in a plant, mini plant, pilot plant, however you want to call it, and they get experience in a plant that's maybe similar to what they maybe would go to when they get employed outside of here. All the while being small enough that we can still teach and we can still offer tours and things like that.
Does the milk that comes into this production facility really come from MSU's like test barns?
It can. So, we don't have a separator here at the facility. So if you know a little bit about milk, milk is a couple different components. So if you were going to make ice cream, you need to separate the cream out of the milk. So you get skim and then you'd have cream. We don't have the ability to do that here. So our process is that we bring in cream from MMPA, which is a pooled source of milk, and Michigan State is part of that. So theoretically, yes, we can get cream that is from MSU cows. But yes, for cheese, we can absolutely get milk right directly from the farm and use that milk to make cheese.
So Matt, what you just showed us, why is it that this facility isn't set up to make Superman or a similar ice cream right now?
Yeah, so to make Superman, you'd have to incorporate three different flavors into one tub. We currently only have the one barrel, the one freezer. We would have to have two more to make the Superman as most people expect it.
So you can do stuff with swirls in it.
I could do stuff with swirls in it. And I could make a Superman version that would be... our joke at my other facility, my other employer, was that we called it adult Superman because it doesn't look like the Superman that maybe a kid would pick out in the cabinet, but tastes like it.
What is adult Superman?
So I would say adult Superman, as we called it, it was a Blue Moon based ice cream. We would put actual strawberries in the ice cream and like as an inclusion. And then we would incorporate a marshmallow swirl that we dyed yellow into the tub.
So you get the flavors of Superman.
Yeah, absolutely. It tastes just like Superman. It just doesn't have that Play-Doh looking look that you're used to when you look in the cabinet.
Yeah. All right. As we're talking through this, I mean, Blue Moon is a very important part of a traditional Superman ice cream. What the heck flavor is Blue Moon?
I've been in the industry a long time. I can't tell you. I have no idea what it is.
You're serious?
I'm serious. I don't know exactly what they use to make Blue Moon.
People may be familiar with Lion Tracks. Can you tell us about the flavor profile of that?
So Lion Tracks would be the same Blue Moon base that we talked about. Instead of using the lighter color blue that we would use to make the Blue Moon and to add color to it, we add a super blue, so it's very, very radiant blue. And then we add cookie dough pieces and Oreo pieces into the Blue Moon ice cream.
Okay, Matt, I know this is going to be asking you to choose among your children, but what's your favorite flavor right now?
My favorite flavor is mint. Chocolate.
Mint chip.
Yes!
We are a mint chip family here, are we not? We all love mint chip. I mean, we love everything.
If I can't get Michigan State ice cream and I go to another dipping store, I get mint.
You
can tell a lot about an ice cream based on its mint chip.
Absolutely.
Its quality.
Now, see, that's how I feel about an ice cream's vanilla. I feel like
That's a true ice cream connoisseur. They're going to go vanilla all day.
If the vanilla tastes good, every other flavor they make is going to be good. If the vanilla is not up to snuff, the rest of it, I don't care what you mix in, it's not going to be good.
I wish you guys would have been here. We started with vanilla. You could have tried it. In my opinion, our vanilla is excellent.
Matt Wilcox, thank you so much for talking to us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for visiting.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.